problem of evil. First of all, I'm going to take the short cut to the problem of evil, not in your notes, and then we'll take the long cut. The shortcut to the problem of evil is to summarize it in terms of a few simple points. It's a little different tact on the problem. If God, why evil? The problem of the nature of evil. First of all, the problem stated. God is the author of everything. Evil is something. Therefore, God is the author of evil. It's probably the simplest statement of the problem of evil, and one of the most difficult, because surely we believe the first two premises, and certainly the conclusion follows logically from them. We don't want to deny premise one, God is the author of everything, because we would be dualist. We would say two eternal things existed, or the devil is able to create, neither of which is compatible with the Christian view. On the other hand, we don't want to deny the second premise, evil is something, because that's what Christian Science does. That's what pantheists do, deny the reality of evil. Well, how can we avoid the conclusion? God is the author of evil. The answer, God is the author of everything. We accept premise one, but we deny premise two. Evil is not a thing. Evil is a lack in things. Hence, three, it does not follow that God created evil. He created everything, and everything is good. Evil is not a good, is not a thing. As opposed to a good thing, there are no evil things. Evil is a lack in good things. There's only one kind of thing in the universe, and there are those that are uncorrupted, those we call completely good, and there are those that are corrupted, those we call evil. Evil is like rust to a car, rot to a tree, and holes to a garment. And we'll go into that in a little more detail. Mine mentioned here, this is the great struggle that St. Augustine went through. He was a Manichaean who believed that evil was an eternal substance. He came out of that, and this is his answer. It was the answer accepted by Anselm, the answer accepted by Aquinas, the answer accepted by all great theists down through the years as to the nature of evil. What is evil? Does it have a substance? The answer is no, evil has no substance of its own. It is a parasite. It exists only in another, but does not exist in itself. That raises the second question, the origin of evil. If evil is a privation by nature, where did the privation come from? Problem stated. One, God made everything perfect. Two, but imperfection cannot come from perfection. Three, so the perfect creature cannot be the origin of evil. Certainly we believe the first premise, that God created everything perfect. He is a perfect creator, and his creation reflects his ability as a perfect creator. But imperfection cannot arise from perfection. Like produces like. How could we possibly get evil from good? Salt water doesn't come from fresh water. And figs do not come from a grapevine. So how do we get the imperfect from the perfect? The answer to that, and again, St. Augustine was one of the first great thinkers to systematically write on this, is that we accept the first premise, God made everything perfect, but we note that one of the perfect things God made was a free creature, that it is not an imperfection to have freedom. In fact, it's a very high kind of perfection. You scarcely ever see anyone carrying signs, down with freedom, back to bondage, I want to do everything my mother tells me. One of the perfections we have is the ability to choose. But free will is the cause of evil. The ability to choose means the ability to choose the higher good or the ability to choose lower goods. Now, in the case of the first created beings, there were no evils to choose. They could either choose the highest good, God, to serve him, or the lower good, themselves, to serve themselves. So the first sin was a good thing called free will, choosing a lower good over a higher good, choosing the self-will of Lucifer over the divine will of the Creator. Hence, imperfection, evil, can arise from the perfect, not directly, but indirectly, through freedom. The perfect cannot directly produce the imperfect, but the perfect can create a perfect being that's perfectly free to do what it decides to do, which can take its good thing called freedom and will the lower good of a creature over the higher good of a creator, which is called evil. Note, God created the fact of freedom. Man performs the acts of freedom. Henry Ford mass produced the car, but we mass kill with it. We don't blame him for every murder performed by an automobile, though he certainly made it possible by mass producing the car. God made evil possible, but creatures make evil actual. What makes evil possible is free will. Every time I gave my teenage daughter the car, I made evil possible. But I certainly didn't actualize evil, although she did once actualize it on the side of a bus. We don't blame God for making evil possible. It's a good thing that evil is possible, because that's called free will. St. Augustine wrote many books on this, one on free will, one entitled On Free Will and Grace. But it's called the Free Will Theodicy. It's been defended as recently by an articulate theist like Alvin Plantinga. The next problem that relates to evil is not the nature of evil or the origin of evil, but it has to do with the persistence of evil. That is, not what is evil, evil is a privation, nor where did it come from, pride, the creature using its free will to exalt itself above God, but why didn't God do something about it? And that perhaps is a more pesky aspect of the problem of evil. Why does evil persist? So let's turn to that problem, the persistence of evil, and say a few words about the nature of the problem of the persistence of evil. First of all, to state the problem in its classic form, if God is all good, he would destroy evil. If God is all powerful, he could destroy evil. But thirdly, look around, evil is not yet destroyed. Hence, it follows that no such God exists. Now, it doesn't mean that no God exists. It means no infinitely good and powerful God exists. In fact, this argument is used by finite godists to justify their view that obviously there must be a creator because the universe is created and designed and must have a designer, but also he obviously can't be perfect because he hasn't destroyed evil. And if he were powerful enough, he could, and if he were good enough, he would. But since he hasn't done it, we can conclude that no such God exists but a finite God. The atheists use this to destroy any kind of God. In either case, it's a problem for theism because it is an argument against an all-perfect, all-good God. Answer. One, let's take evil in the strong sense of the word, or rather, let's take the word destroy in the strong sense of the word. Evil cannot be destroyed without destroying freedom. And we can argue this as follows. Love is the greatest good for free creatures, but love is impossible without freedom. You cannot be forced to love. Love is a free choice. So to destroy freedom would be to destroy the greatest good. If love is the greatest good for a free creature, and you cannot love without freedom, then the only way to destroy freedom would also destroy the greatest good for free creatures. Hence, to destroy evil completely, God would have to destroy freedom, which makes the greatest good possible. You might liken it rather satirically to the atheist who claims that God isn't doing anything about evil, he should destroy it, and yet who wants their free will. For example, does Madeline Murray O'Hare really want God to destroy all evil? If she does, then she wants God to destroy her, because she's a big pile of evil. Does she really want God, every time she opens her atheistic mouth, to cram it with cotton? That would destroy a lot of evil. It just pours out of her mouth. Does she really want God, every time she picks up her atheistic fountain pen, to explode it in her hand so she can't write any evil? That would take care of a lot of evil. And does she really want God, every time she has an evil thought, to give her an Excedrin headache, number three? That would also keep down the evil. You say, no, that would be a violation of her freedom to think and to choose and to write. See, the only way you can destroy all evil is to destroy free creatures. Now, what do you have left? Stones. So in the strong sense of the word, destroying evil would destroy all good, as you can't have the possibility for good unless you have the possibility for evil. It's called free will. So let's take it in the weak sense. Couldn't God at least defeat evil? Couldn't he at least keep it in control? Looks to me like it's running rampant in the world. Well, in the weak sense of the word destroy, which we'll take as defeat, evil will yet be defeated. Let's take the argument this way. If God is all-powerful, he can defeat evil. If he's all-good, he will defeat evil. And note that the third premise should read, evil is not yet defeated, because time isn't over. We're still in the process. Therefore, evil will one day be defeated. Now, here's where the value of doing theism first comes in. Here's where the value of points 1 through 15 come in. We have already shown in points 1 through 15 that there is an infinitely good God who's infinitely powerful. That means the first premise means should read, there is an all-powerful God who can defeat evil. The second one should read, there is an all-good God who would defeat evil. Third one should read, evil is not yet defeated. And the fourth one should read, therefore evil will one day be defeated. And the reason we know it will is because that kind of God exists. And were he all good, he would. And were he all powerful, he could. And he is both of those. And it isn't yet done, so hold on. It's coming. And we know it's coming by the very nature of God. He cannot not defeat evil because he is all powerful. He cannot will not to do it because he is all good. And if it hasn't yet been completed, then join the pre-mill group and believe that it is. Don't stick there with your post-mill or a-mill head in the sand and say it's not happened, therefore it can't ever happen. There is a future. There's a last chapter that hasn't been written. And it's just as meaningless to say God can't do it because he hasn't yet, as it is to say to a car in the middle of the assembly line, this thing will never become a car because it's not yet a car. Well, it's just in the process. Wait till it gets to the end of the line. The fourth problem of evil has to do with the purpose of evil. To state the problem, one, there is no good purpose for much suffering. There's a lot of wasted suffering, useless suffering. Now, it's true that some suffering produces good. We all read Johnny, and we all hear of angels unawares, the mongoloid child of Roy Rogers and Dale Evans that turned their lives back to the Lord. And we all hear these wonderful stories about suffering that produced a lot of good. But how about the suffering that didn't produce any good? How about the wasted suffering? How about the suffering nobody heard about? How about the innocent suffering? How about catching babies on bayonets? How about all of the gross inhumanities to man that have been done? 2, an all good being, God, must have a good purpose for everything. Can't be all good and have good purpose for just some things. You have to have a good purpose for everything. Because if you didn't have a good purpose for everything, you wouldn't be completely, perfectly good. But there obviously is not a good purpose for much suffering. Hence, 3, there cannot be an all-good God. If there were an all-good God, there would be a good purpose for everything. There is not a good purpose for everything, therefore, there is not an all-good God. Now, in response to this objection, we must make a distinction. The distinction is, even if we don't know God's purposes, he may still have a good purpose for evil. It's one of the most important distinctions to be made. George Mavrides, a professor of philosophy at University of Michigan, in his little book on the existence of God, has made this, and I think it's one of the best strokes ever made by a theist. Very important distinction between our knowing the purposes of God and God's having these purposes. It's an obvious truth that even if I don't know God's purposes, he still has one. And it's a self-evident truth that God is omniscient, if he is omniscient, and if he's omnibenevolent, that he must have a good purpose. Because if he knows everything, and he's all good in what he knows, then he's got a purpose that we know not of. So all the argument proves is man's finitude, not God's evil, when it says that there can't be a God because we don't know the good purposes. Furthermore, we do know some of the good purposes. God has not left us totally in the dark. For instance, some evil is to warn us of greater evil. Sharp pain in the lower right side has a good purpose. Warns you you're about to need an appendectomy. Or sharp pains in your chest can be very good pains because it's a warning to slow down. You may have a heart attack. Pain in your tooth. It's time to go to the dentist and so forth. The warning pains are good pains, so to speak. Probably the best book written on this topic is The Problem of Pain by C.S. Lewis. Secondly, there's a good purpose for evil because a lot of it keeps us from self-destruction. The best book I know of on this topic is Where is God When It Hurts by Philip Yancey, who, based on the famous doctor's work with people who had leprosy, concluded that God has a good purpose in allowing pain, because if he didn't, we would destroy ourselves. For example, they discovered that over 90% of the deformation of the extremities of a leper's body, fingers and toes, come not from the disease, but from the leper destroying their own fingers by putting in the fire, because leprosy destroys your ability to sense pain. So the leper will put his finger in the fire and he'll burn it off. Can't feel it. Or hit it with a hammer, knock it off. So the leper is really destroying himself in over 90% of the cases, not the leprosy. So one of the reasons God gives pain is to keep us from self-destruction. Yeah, otherwise we would destroy ourselves. So the doctor worked up a system whereby he could help the lepers to know they were in a danger. He worked up what amounts to a bleep system. When they got near fire, a little bleeper would go on. And to his surprise, it didn't work. And the reason it didn't work is he discovered that it wasn't strong enough. A bleep won't do it. For example, people who don't want to wear seat belts, the little bleep on the dashboard doesn't change their mind, does it? A head through the window sometimes does. I know it did in our family, but not my head, someone else's head. But it doesn't always change people's mind to hear a little bleep. You need something a little stronger. So the doctor decided that another lesson to be learned
is in order for pain to be effective, it must be strong enough. So the purpose of pain is to keep us from self-destruction, and two, it's got to be strong enough to work. I can't think of a world much better suited to do that than the one in which we live. So then he hooked up what amounted to a shock treatment to them. Every time they got near a fire, they'd get a real zap, not just a bleed. He discovered that didn't work twice, because after somebody got zapped once, the leper was smart enough to turn the system off when he got near that kind of situation again. So that led to another conclusion that he made about the purpose for pain. The only way for pain to be effective is, one, to be strong enough, and two, it's got to be out of our control. If we have it in our control, we'll always turn it down. Now, that's the kind of world we live in, friends. A world of pain that has a good purpose, that's really strong, and that's really out of our control. But it's in the control of a sovereign God, whom we know exists, infinitely good, infinitely knowing. And if I can't determine why the ouch has to be that big, I just trust that God knows why it has to be that big. Also, we know to help bring about greater goods is a third purpose for evil. There are a lot of first order evils that are necessary for second order goods. For instance, there's no way to be a great pianist without the pain of practicing daily, regularly. Who was the great pianist who said, if I don't practice one day, I know if I don't practice 2 days, my close friends knows if I don't practice 3 days, the whole world knows. And you have to be there every day, hour after hour after hour. To be a great athlete, it takes blood, sweat, and tears. Most locker rooms has had that sign in it at one time or another. The only way to success is blood, sweat, and tears. It's painful. And most of the great athletes play in constant pain of some kind or another. Well, there is no way to get second-order goods, victory, achievement, success, attainment, whatever you want, without going through pain. Someone said the only way to get to the promised land is to go through the wilderness. Or Christians are like tea. Their real strength comes out when they get in hot water. To help bring about greater goods, you need first-order evils. Romans 5 says, tribulation worketh patience. There just is no other way to get patience. I remember first time I ever prayed for patience, which probably was the last time. Three flat tires, the transmission fell out of the car that day. Just every conceivable thing happened. Pray for patience, you get tribulation, because there is no way to get patience without getting tribulation. Then finally, one of the purposes to permit evil is to defeat it. You can't beat the champ unless you get in the ring with him. There is no way to defeat evil unless you permit evil. So part of God's great plan to conquer evil was to allow evil. Otherwise, evil would not have had a chance to rear its ugly head, to lift its militant fist, and therefore to receive a KO blow. From my standpoint, what happened is that God planned a 7-round, winner-take-all, knockout bout. And he let evil fight during 7 different rounds, under 7 different styles and conditions. And in the 6th round, there was a staggering blow given to evil. Evil was officially KO'd, but it kind of reared its head one more time in the last round and was given the final knockout during the millennium and was put away forever. It's called dispensationalism. And there were different conditions by which God permitted evil to exist in order to destroy it. How many times have you heard people say, well, it's not fair, look at all the evil in the world? Well, there was a time when there was no evil, called the Garden of Eden, paradise, absolute paradise, look what we did. And people say, yeah, but we don't have much direction from God. Well, there was a time when he told them how to tie their shoes and go to the toilet. Old Testament. He told them to take a paddle in the wilderness, dig a little hole, told them everything. They didn't do too well there either, did they? One toot and you're out. That's the law. Well, every one of those dispensations, the devil was around. The devil made me do it. Okay, I'll tie him up for 1,000 years. How'd you do there? Not too well. Perfect reign of Christ for 1,000 years, and they rebel, untold numbers, after the millennium. So evil's had its chance. God has his purposes, and his purpose is to defeat it. How do we know? Because he's all good, and he would do it, and he's all powerful, and he can, and he's all smart, and he's got a plan. That's how we know. And he's even given us a little insight into the plan. He's given us a little book to tell us what he's up to, called Bible. So to say that there is no good purpose for evil is the ultimate height of arrogance for an atheist, because he has to assume that he's omniscient. That takes us to another problem, and that is the extent of evil. Surely any sensitive person has been concerned about the extent of evil in the world. There is a whole lot of it, and you might say to yourself, yeah, I see that. Surely God would want to defeat it, and maybe he'd have to permit it, and there's no way to get the greatest good but evil, but this much, Lord, looks like a little too much. Well, let's state the problem. The greatest good is to save all men. I can see why you might want to let people fall into sin to defeat it, but surely God would want to get everybody out of sin too. Even one person in hell would be less than the greatest good. Reminds me of the famous Roman Catholic liberal Teilhard de Chardin, who said, yes, I'm a Catholic. Yes, I have to believe in hell. No, I don't have to believe anyone's going there. Well, that certainly is the wish of everyone. I believe is the wish of God himself, that no one goes to hell. Isn't that what 2 Peter 3:9 says? The Lord is long-suffering, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. So we can certainly agree that the greatest good would be to save all men, and even one person in hell would be less than the greatest good. But, therefore, God can't send anyone to hell. That poses a problem for a biblical theist. A biblical theist has to believe that someone is going to hell, because the Bible says Satan will be there. It says his angels will be there. It says the beast and the false prophet will be there. And it says Judas will be there, because he was a son of perdition. It'd been better if he had never been born. And it says everyone who was not found written in the book of life will be there. So for a biblical theist, we must have an answer to this particular objection. I would suggest this answer. One, God certainly does desire all people to be saved. Now, there are biblical theists who don't seem to believe this. Let me illustrate. There are biblical theists who seem to believe something like this. There's a little sign by the pond, do not swim here, no trespassing. But the boys jump over the fence and they're swimming and they're drowning in the pond, all five of them. The farmer comes by and he looks up at the sign and he looks down at the boys and said, they disobeyed the law, they all deserve to drown, and he goes on his way. Was he loving? Well, most of us would say, no, he was not. Well, let's change the scenario. The farmer came by and he looked at the sign and he looked down at the boys and said, you all deserve to drown, but I feel gracious today. I'm going to rescue one of you. Was he loving? Well, most of us would say no, except, of course, the hyper-Calvinist. That's precisely what the hyper-Calvinist says. I find that view unbiblical, irrational, and existentially repugnant, and any other unkind thing. I think God really wants all people to be saved. Surely the boys deserve to drown. Of course they deserve to drown. Of course they disobeyed the law. Of course justice demands that. But that's looking at only one attribute of God. there's another attribute of God called love. God is all just and they deserve to drown. He's also all loving and he wants to try and rescue them. And any farmer who would try and rescue none or one or a few and not try and rescue all is less than all good. And any God is exactly the same. See, the God of hyper-Calvinism isn't the God of the Bible. He's a kind of an Arabian sheikh, an arbitrary, capricious monarch who at his whim decides who will and who won't, but who could care less if the rest go to hell. No, God is really compassionate, loving, concerned for all men. God so loved the world. The Holy Spirit is in the world, convincing the world of sin, righteousness, and judgment. However, there is a problem. God cannot force anyone to love him. Forced love is a contradiction in terms. The farmer can throw out the lifeline, but he can't force the person to take it. God can send the help, but he can't cram it down their throat. That is, not if he's going to respect their freedom and dignity. You see, God is not a cosmic B.F. Skinner. He doesn't behaviorally mod people into the kingdom. There are no shotgun weddings in heaven. There will be no one there under duress. Yes, C.S. Lewis used an unfortunate phrase in one of his books that people misunderstand. He said, God brought me screaming and kicking into the kingdom. But he did not mean that God forced him, because in his book, Screwtape Letters, C.S. Lewis said, God never uses irresistible grace on unwilling people. Incidentally, if you want to see that same point made by a very strong Calvinist, whom you might recognize, page 126 and 127 of his book, The Holy Spirit, Dr. Walbert made that same distinction. Irresistible grace is only used on willing people. It's never used on unwilling. If it's used on unwilling, then they're forced against their will. Suppose you're in a backyard, sunny and a beautiful day. The hornets come along, and you decide to go to the front yard. Did you go freely? Yes and no. It's not what you really wanted to do. You were more or less forced to go to the front yard. Question is, to take the drugs. The alcoholic doesn't want to have a hangover, but he will to have a hangover because he will to take the alcohol. The man who commits suicide by jumping off a cliff doesn't want to hit the bottom. In fact, they usually scream on the way down, but they will to hit the bottom because they will to jump off. 2 weeks ago, I was in Birmingham, Alabama, giving a TV interview. Somebody burst in the door and said, a lady has just committed suicide, just jumped off the tower outside. We went outside and there was her body. Police weren't there, ambulance wasn't there. Somebody felt her pulse, she was dead. Two black men, and I may say with white faces, were standing there. They saw her coming down, screaming. She willed to do it. She didn't want the consequences, but she willed the consequences, and they heard her scream on the way down. It's a rather sobering experience to realize that over the same tower that the message that I was giving, which is about the meaninglessness of life and the takeover of humanism in our society, someone was climbing up that tower and jumping off. It's an experience, believe me, that I will never forget. And I didn't see the fall. I just saw the result after it. People who are in hell will to be there. There are no unwilling people. Lewis says in Problem of Pain, the door of hell is locked on the inside. And the best insight into hell in the 20th century, so far as I can see, other than C.S. Lewis, was an atheist, Jean-Paul Sartre, in his play No Exit. He has three people in hell. And in the middle of the play, the door of hell opens up, and they're given a chance to leave, and no one leaves. Here's an atheist who says, man is condemned to his own freedom. And were he given a chance to leave hell, he wouldn't leave. Nietzsche once said in the last line of his book, The Genealogy of Morals, I would rather will nothingness than not to will at all. We would rather will the eternal recurrence of the same absurd state of affairs than not to will anything. So I think our answer is God does desire all men to be saved, and he's doing everything he can to get them saved, but he will not go beyond freedom and dignity. He will not force freedom. He will not dehumanize us in the process of saving us. He will not save people at any cost, if it means the cost of their freedom and the cost of their dignity, because that also means the cost of his dignity and of his love by forcing them to do it. Let me put it as simply as I can and as forcefully. You were proposing to a young lady. You said, I want you to marry me. She said, I don't want to marry you. You say, well, I love you and God will bless our lives together. She said, look, I don't want to marry you. And you persisted and said, well, I want to marry you so much, I'm going to force you to marry me. What would you say? You would say, forced love is not love. Forced love is rape. And God is not a divine rapist. He doesn't force anyone to love him. And that's why there is a hell. There is not only a hell because God is just and must punish sin, but there's a hell because God is loving and can't force people to go to heaven. Read The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. Note, it is not one person in hell which would make it evil, but one more than is really necessary. It's not that there is a hell that makes it an evil in the universe. It's that there would be a hell with more people there than should be there. A world with some in hell is not the best world conceivable, but it may be the best world achievable. Who said that we're going to get the best of all conceivable worlds? The best of all conceivable worlds would be a world in which no one ever sinned, but Adam did sin. Or the best of all conceivable worlds, once somebody sinned, would be a world in which everybody got saved. But unfortunately, the best of all conceivable worlds is not the best of all achievable worlds with free creatures. On the other hand, notice this. If the hyper-Calvinist is right, that God can achieve anything he wants, even against people's free will, then everybody ought to be saved and universalism ought to follow. Because if God can use irresistible grace on unwilling people and zap anybody and make them saved, and he is all-loving, then he ought to do it on everyone. And if he can do it on everyone, and he ought to do it on everyone, then the final logical conclusion of hyper-Calvinism is universalism or arbitrary selectivism. A God who is only partially loving or a world that is entirely saved. Between those two extremes, I see no other alternative than a theodicy like C.S. Lewis's here, a solution to the problem by saying, yes, it's conceivable more could have been saved, but it was not achievable without violating their free will.
I have a long, drawn-out question, but in your illustration with the farmer and the tank, you're presupposing that that tank, you know, functions in some worthwhile manner. Maybe it's for irrigation or to feed his cattle, and so people stumble in there and, you know, he tries to save them, or a good farmer would. Now, what about, let's say the farmer just didn't have a tank, he just dug a really deep pit, there were crocodiles down there, and then people fell in, and then he tried to save some of them. who's really at fault? I mean, the boys for falling in, or the farmer for digging what we would presume to be an unnecessary pit?
Well, if he tries to save all of them, if he really earnestly tries to rescue them, then that would alleviate this aspect of the problem, wouldn't it? What makes the problem acute for the hyper-Calvinist is that he isn't even attempting to save all of them. In fact, a real hyper-Calvinist believes that Christ didn't even die for all of them, let alone the Holy Spirit trying to work all of them. So the crocodile or the other part of your illustration is irrelevant. It becomes a smokescreen for the real problem. The real problem is the farmer really earnestly trying to save all of them once it did happen? We can debate about whether there should have been crocodiles there to begin with or not, and that's an attractive hazard and that whole problem. That's not the problem I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about leaving the impression with people that the Bible teaches that God is only partially loving, that Christ only died for some and he's only trying to rescue some, and that somehow or other that is in accordance with the attributes of God. That is in accordance with one attribute of God to punish sin, but it is also in accordance with another attribute of God to try and rescue every sinner. And that's the point I think that the hyper-Calvinist fails on, and that the illustration fails on. In the illustration, will we still have free will? Yes. But it will be fulfilled freedom. The way you have free will in marriage, you are in the bonds of marriage. You freely decided never to go out with anyone else. And that freedom is fulfilled permanently. You freely decide never to want to sin again, and heaven will fulfill that freedom. So it will be fair, yet free, yet permanent. Fair because you freely decided to put yourself in the bonds of those of eternal love. Free because that was a decision you made rationally and morally, but impossible for you to sin, because it will be permanentized by God and all evil will be taken from your environment and from your nature. Is hell evil? Hell is evil in the sense that it's a privation or a lack, a bad relationship, but it is not evil in the sense that the things that are there are evil. For example, hell is like a scrapyard, a junkyard. You can still see that was a Volkswagen, but it's totaled. It's totally unredeemable. That was a Cadillac that'll never be the same again. So there's still the remnants, the image of God in fallen people is still in them while they're in hell. So there's good there, but it is unredeemable good. But hell itself is an evil for them, but it is a good for the universe, because it's good to punish evil. It's not good to let evil go unpunished. If you let evil go unpunished, you are not good. So hell is good in the sense that it reflects the attribute of God called justice. It is good in the sense that it punishes evil called sin. It is good in the sense that the people who are there, what is left of them and the image of God that is eroded, is good, but it is evil to them and for them. Six, the problem of the avoidability of evil. This problem stated is that God knows everything, and God knew evil would occur when he created the world. In fact, he knew it would occur before he created the world. God had other non-evil possibilities he could have done. Number one, he could have not created anything. Number two, he could have not created anything free, the stones and animals. Or three, he could have created free creatures that would not sin. Or four, he could have created free creatures who would sin, but who would all be saved in the end. Now here's the problem. If God knew everything, and he knew evil would occur, and he knew that there were other possibilities that he could have done, and those other possibilities would have involved no sin at all, or no sin in the end, why didn't he will one of those other worlds? Looks like he willed the wrong world. So this is a problem internal to theism, because we admit all of these premises. We admit he was free and did not have to create. We admit he was all-knowing and knew the end from the beginning. And we admit that all of these others are logical possibilities, not to create, or not to create anything free, or to create free creatures who would not sin, or to create free creatures who would sin but who would all be saved in the end. So if we admit all of that, it seems like we have a severe problem of the avoidability of evil. God could have avoided a world having evil in it, or at least he could have avoided the world having evil in it in the end, namely everybody getting saved. Now the problem is probably the most significant one in the contemporary scene. That is, this is the argument that is most forcefully given by atheists today. Mackey, a famous atheist, is the one who popularized this. Let's reply, first of all, to point one of the alternatives that God could have created no world at all. The implication there is that no world at all would be morally better than the world that was created. It wrongly implies that nothing is morally better than something. Didn't Jesus say it would have been better if Judas had never been born? Doesn't that imply that nothing, a state of nothingness, would have been better than the state of punishment that Judas will go through? And the answer to that is no, it does not. In the case of Jesus' use of that statement, that was a hypothetical hyperbole indicating the intensity of Judas' sin. Parallel passages talk about more tolerable for. He was saying, look how bad it is for Judas. That's terrible punishment. My goodness, it would have been better if he had never been born. But to say that nothingness is better than something is absurd, for the simple reason that nothing and something have nothing in common. And in order to compare something, you have to have a common ground. You can compare apples and oranges. We say that's apples and oranges. Can't compare. You can. They're both fruit. You can compare them. But you can't compare apples and non-apples, because there's nothing in common. I used to argue 10, 15 years ago with Shakespeare that to be is better than not to be. It's better to exist than not to exist. Then it was pointed out to me that you can't say that existence is better than non-existence because you don't have anything to compare the two with. Non-existence doesn't have any existence in it to compare with existence. So how can you compare nothing and something and say something is better than nothing? And I accepted the validity of that criticism and gave up that argument that it was better to create than not to create. But if something is not better than nothing, then neither can nothing be better than something. Works both ways. That being can't be better than non-being, then neither can non-being be better than being. And one thing is for sure, that creating no world is not a moral problem, because it wrongly implies that nothing is morally better than something. But nothing can't be morally better than something. Nothing isn't even moral at all. It's amoral. And what is amoral cannot be immoral. And no world at all is an amoral situation. You have to have a moral situation before you have a moral problem, and to say that nothing is better than something is to say that the non-moral or amoral is morally better than the moral. So the first alternative is not a moral problem. Sure, God could have created nothing, but you can't say that would have been morally better than creating something. Secondly, the second problem, not created anything free, wrongly assumes that non-free creatures can be compared to free ones. Say it would have been better to have all robots, all animals, and no human beings, no angels, no one with free will that can sin, wrongly assumed that it would be a morally better situation not to have a moral situation. You only have a moral situation when you have free moral beings. So a situation with no free moral beings is not a moral situation at all. It's an amoral situation again. So you cannot say B, no create, no free creatures would have been morally better than free creatures, because no free creatures is not moral, and what is not moral cannot be morally better than anything. The real problem gets to C and D. Could he have created free creatures that would not sin, or if he could have created free creatures who would not sin, who would sin, then why didn't he create free creatures who would sin but who would all be saved in the end? Both of these we can answer in one argument. It is possible that these two alternatives, C and D, would never come about freely, and God can't force freedom. It's possible, it's logically possible, that any world God had created, some free creature would have sinned. Let me illustrate it from dice. If I throw three dice and get three sixes on the first throw, what do you think? Lucky. What if I throw three dice the second time and get three sixes? Very lucky. What if I throw it three times in a row and get three sixes three times in a row? Suspicious. What if I throw it 100 times and I get three sixes every time? Loaded. Or sixes on each side, yeah, or something. It's loaded. What if God created all the creatures in the universe and everyone all the time always chose to go his way? Loaded. There's just some kind of suspicion built into, if they're really free and they could go right and left and they all only go right, weren't they conditioned to go right? Weren't they somehow behavioralistically determined or divinely determined to go right? Were they really free if they all went right? It is possible that no world would ever have materialized in the scenarios that flash before the infinite mind of omniscience in the council chambers of eternity. It is possible that no scenario ever appeared on that screen, that a world that would actually materialize had no one that would ever sin. Consequently, their argument doesn't follow to say that God had to create the other kind of world, because in a free world, of course, whether they freely use their freedom one way or another will be ultimately decided by how they decide to use their freedom. Of course, God knows this, and he knows that in creating this kind of world, he can bring about the greater good in the end, but at the same time, it is possible that no such world would have materialized. I would add to that answer that I believe that even if God could have created a world where people were free and no one would have sinned, he probably would not have created that world, for the simple reason that it would not have been the best of all possible worlds, because it would not have achieved the greatest good of defeating evil forever, of showing how evil evil is and how good good is, and consequently the universe would still have hanging over it the possibility of evil, because it had never been tried. You can't beat the opponent unless you get in the ring with him. God permitted it to defeat it, and to permit it and defeat it is better than not to permit it at all. This doesn't mean you beat your head on the wall because it feels so good when you stop. You don't promote evil in order to defeat evil, but it does mean when you get a toothache, you go to the dentist and permit the pain of the drrrr in order to get the pleasure that results after that. We permit evil to produce a good, but we do not promote evil to produce a good. God created a world in which evil was possible in order that he could actualize the greatest good. Even if evil were avoidable, unless it were permitted, it would not be defeatable. Therefore, God permitted evil to defeat evil. What if God supernaturally intervened?
Right.
That's another question we deal with too a little later. But just think of this. If you supernaturally intervene to prevent people from performing free acts, then they're not free. And in effect, what you've done is said, you are free, but you aren't free. It's kind of like saying to Madeline Murray O'Hara, you are free as long as you don't think any atheistic thoughts, write any atheistic books, or make any atheistic gestures. Well, she's not free then, is she? And if God zapped her, you know, suppose every time somebody took a knife to stab another human being in the back, God turned it to jello. Suppose every time he took a bullet to shoot someone else, the bullet turned to cotton. That's possible. He can do those miracles. Supposing that every time somebody took a noose to tie around another human being's neck, it turned to a noodle. What if God supernaturally intervened at every point to prevent evil from occurring? Well, first of all, there's the problem of, are they free? If they aren't free to do the opposite of what he wants them to do. Secondly, there's the problem of the complete disruption of the natural world. It would make even rational moral decisions impossible if miracles occurred willy-nilly. Because once miracles occur willy-nilly, you can't depend on natural laws. You can't even make rational actions, because all of your actions that are rational and moral are dependent on a regular pattern of the universe in which to make those laws. So it would even destroy the ability to make moral choices by disrupting the regularity of the world. And we'll develop that argument a little more later on. It would destroy your freedom and destroy the ability for freedom to operate. Say, what caused Lucifer to sin? That's the kind of thing you get into in a deterministic view of the world, where you say, God determines your free will, and God determined Lucifer's free will, then God determined that Lucifer sinned. And what's repugnant about that is, obviously, if you make God the only actor in the universe where God is performing that action, that explains how the action occurred, but it doesn't explain how God can rape, and how God can murder, and how God can be brutal, can engage in child abuse. So it goes too far in that direction. But if you simply say, man has free will is the self-determined act to do it, then man is responsible. And if you don't ask what caused man to do it, then you don't get into a category mistake, because God didn't cause him to do it. God gave him the fact of freedom, and he's performing the acts of freedom. But that's what freedom means, is that you have the ability to do it yourself. And if you don't have the ability to do it yourself, then somebody else has to do it for you. In the case of Lucifer, there was only one other being to do it. That would be God. And even Jonathan Edwards admits that that's the insoluble problem in his deterministic system. How could God have caused Lucifer to sin and then still blame Lucifer? And if God didn't, then was Lucifer's act uncaused? Because he eliminates the third alternative, that Lucifer's act was self-caused. He rejects that view of freedom, that freedom is a self-caused act. Well, it's either self-caused, caused by another, or uncaused. It can't be uncaused, Edwards says, and it wasn't self-caused. There, who do you have left? God caused Lucifer to sin. And I think the only way out of that is to say that free acts are self-caused acts. That who caused me to sin? I did. Well, what caused me to do it? Nothing. I was the cause. And then you get it right back to the first cause. It's just meaningless. There's an infinite regress on the cause of being. You can't go back infinitely, because there had to be a first cause of being. And you can't go back infinitely to moral actions. They have to stop. The buck has to stop somewhere. Now, the buck doesn't stop at the rock I threw to hit you in the head. You say, well, the rock did. I didn't do it. Now, you won't see any of my fingerprints on this bloody body. That won't do in court, will it? Where does the buck stop? The buck stops not at the rock, it stops at, and then stop at my hand. You don't arrest my hand and put it to jail, do you? The buck stops at me, a free moral agent who decided to do that. Why is it so universal, and why is it so persistent? It does not account for the apparent reality of an evil. Why is it that when I sit upon a pin that punctuates my skin, I dislike what I fancy I feel? It does not avoid the charge that the view is itself an illusion, a mere wishful thinking. I think that's a very legitimate charge to make, kind of pull the Freud on the pantheist. Freud says religion is an illusion. It'd be nice to have a cosmic comforter, heavenly Linus blanket. But, after all, that's the only basis you have for believing that. Well, of course, that's not the only basis we have for believing. We have a rational basis, see points 1 through 15. But let's turn that on the pantheist. What basis does he have for believing that evil is really an illusion? Well, it'd be nice if it were that way. I hope it's that way. I think it's that way. I wish it's that way. But really, it isn't. It involves a pantheistic view of the universe, which must be rejected because it's incompatible with theism's view that God is transcendently different from the world. Or, to put it another way, that there is at least one finite, real creature which undeniably and changeably exists. It's also incompatible with the religious experience of God is really other. In pantheism, you experience God as the same. Atman is Brahman. The depth of your soul is identical to the depth of the universe. Pantheism is contrary to religious experience. It's contrary to the universality persistence of evil and to the contingency of man. There's another solution not open to us. Hardly anybody holds the view. Sadism. The claim that God is deliberately inflicting evil on the world for the joy of it. It's interesting that there aren't many real sadists. Now, there are people in moments of discouragement feel that God is a sadist. Job had a little bit of that from chapter 3 on. C.S. Lewis experienced some of that in A Grief Observed when his wife died. But very few people hold the view. It's more of an emotional state of affairs temporarily experienced than it is a philosophical structure. But at any rate, it's a possible view, which we argue is contrary to the theistic premise that God is all good, point 9. And it would place the ultimate standard for good beyond God, thus making it God by definition. Because if God is not good, then you have to know what the good is. So there has to be some absolute standard of good beyond God by which God is measured to be bad. In essence, sadism, at best, turns out to be a proof of the devil, because it proves that there is an evil being who does inflict evil on people for the sake of it. And if you could prove sadism, you would be proving a devil, because in order to know he's evil, you have to measure him over against something that's absolutely good. Therefore, that absolutely good would be God, and this evil, sadistic being would be the devil. Place the ultimate standard for good beyond God, which is wrong, for there must be an ultimate norm by which God is judged to be ultimately evil, but the norm cannot be within God, else he would not be judged evil, since he would be acting according to the ultimately good norm of his own nature. Nor could there be an ultimate good beyond God, which by his very nature is ultimate and good, would be identical with God, for there can't be two all-perfect beings. Further, it is incompatible with theism to affirm God is both creator and destroyer simultaneously. Sadistic God would be both sustaining and destroying life simultaneously. He'd be both loving and hating it, both for and against it at the same time. But these are mutually exclusive and impossible activities. Hence, sadism is contrary to theism. Finite Godism, very popular since the days of John Stuart Mill, William James, Brightman, Boston University has been a fountainhead of this view, says that God is limited in love and or power. Also interesting to note, the few people who hold the finite God view hold that God is all-powerful but only partially loving. You'll find people who hold that God is all-loving but partially powerful. They find it very difficult to do, which again shows the illusory nature of religion. Would like to believe that he is all loving and just hampered in his power, but no one would like to believe that he is all powerful and hampered in his love. The objections to finite Godism can be found in a very famous evangelical writing, John Carnell. He did his doctoral dissertation on this problem at Boston University. He was one of the first and most brilliant evangelical writers, and he has two good chapters in his Christian apologetics book on the problem of evil and finite godism. Number one, the theistic God is infinite, both in power and love. 9 and 10. How so? Well, because if he's infinite and a necessary being, he must necessarily be whatever he is. So if he's powerful, he's infinitely powerful. If he's loving, he's infinitely.